And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice a board meeting in writing, please email monica@kboo.org.
Hailing all listeners, DJ Dim Sums here from the Astro Traveling Collective. Tune your mind, body, and soul in this Sunday at 6:30 p.m. I'll be talking with my guests, Chicago's Bad Boys of Jazz, the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. They played Arlene Schnitz on the 16th. Eight sons of the great jazz trumpeter and one of the founding members of the AACM, Phil Caron. We will travel through the now music that is the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble. Tune in this Sunday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Bread and Roses, feminist news and public affairs on the KBOO airwaves since 1978, the longest-running feminist radio broadcast program in the country. Bread and Roses is a collective of women and non-binary radio activists who give voice to those in global and local spaces, working for social justice and equity, and we strive to challenge systems of oppression. All this, and we have fun. We want our bread and roses too, get it? I'm your host tonight, Pamela Santos, and we have two engineers, Lenita and Adam, thank you. We've got a great show tonight. It will be Unchaste Readers here live in the studio, and I'll be introducing them in a moment. But of course, I just want to let you all know that we're going to be reading pretty much, I would say, radio ready, radio friendly material, but just be aware, it's art, kids. It's art. It's poetry, I don't know, you know? The metaphors, if they're just a little too risque, like maybe, you know, tell the kids to go. Thank you. So just to tell you about Unchaste Readers, they've been here before, and I'll just introduce them a little bit. Unchaste Readers are women aged 14 to 71 who've read at the Unchaste Readers series anytime between April 2012 and right now. Unchaste is about creating a community, promoting writing that takes risks, that shows the raw, vulnerable, ecstatic, complicated lives of women and non-binary folk. They have been all kinds of sexual preference spectrum, women gender spectrum, race, ethnicity, social economic, political status in the hierarchy, patriarchy, experience, survivor. There's a lot of slashes here. Not as much survivor slash writer, reading, speaking, singing, playing, music forms. And we have three of them. We're going to have three of them tonight. And what we're going to do, just so that you're prepared, dear listeners, we are definitely going to be having an opportunity to have everyone read a piece. And then we're going to have discussion and some music in between. But I will let you know that, you know, we've got to also cleanse our minds a little bit. We're not going to ignore that it is 3 days after the election. It feels like my head is starting to clear just a little tiny bit, but not that much. And as much as we definitely had a complete, you know, show planned for this, I think it would be just not genuine or really true to what we're doing and also what Unchaste is about if we didn't speak our minds. And this is on our minds, okay? And I think it's on a lot of your minds. It's on a lot of our minds. And so we're going to mix art and politics tonight. And that's as much of an intro as I wanted to give. So first off, what we're going to do is I'm going to introduce each Unchaste reader, and they're going to read a poem afterwards, or writing piece. So let's start first with Mari Shepherd Glenn. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm going to read your bio, and then you can go ahead, and then we'll go to the next person. As proud native Portlander, creative enthusiast, and dream weaver, Mari Shepherd Glenn seeks to mix their personal experiences with the voices and tones of the Pacific Northwest, while still echoing sentiments held around the world. Besides language, they have a strong love of coffee, travel, antiques, and the ocean. As a sophomore reader at Unchaste, Mari is excited to bring new material to the table. They are currently working on a collection of published poems. You can find their poetry online at allseasonshalo.wordpress.com. Welcome, Mari.
Thank you. This piece I wrote a few weeks ago. It's called I've Never Broken a Bone. I've never broken a bone the way most kids do. Never fallen downstairs, never had to be shared custody. But I have had my hair touched, learned how to humor people my size and twice that. No tower too big to fall, to do it wrong. I learned how to peer out of windows right, read right and write right, talk right and talk white. I matured into a thing and internalized it all, that safe wall. It taught me everything. Taught me how to safely fall. Without them seeing me, that's how I'm supposed to exist, right? A painting on a wall, price to sell, something to look at, something to take home and hang on your wall, so that your friends can stare at me during dinner parties and admire the beauty of everything they hate, but can't place why.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the next person on is Jenny Forrester. Jenny Forrester has been published in a number of print and online publications, including Seattle's City Arts Magazine, Gobshite Quarterly, Nailed Magazine, Hip Mama, The Literary Kitchen, Indiana Review, and Columbia Journal. Her work is included in the Listen to Your Mother anthology, published by Putnam. She curates the Unchaste Readers series. Her forthcoming memoir, Narrow River, Wide Sky, will be published by Hawthorne Books in spring of 2017, and we can't wait.
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you very much. I'm going to read a piece by Anna Dugan, Unchaste, and it is called I'm Afraid I Can't See Over Your Hair. I used I was used to it. My hair often caused chaos. Your hair be throwing gang signs. Your hair is a fractal. You should rethink that hair. I'm afraid I can't see over your hair, by Anna Dugan. The noisy conversations dropped to mumbles as the lights dimmed. In the darkness, the rustling of coats being slipped off, the squeak of the movie theater seats suddenly holding weight, crinkling and ripping as candy was opened, popcorn passed, the slurping straws, an occasional cough, awkward whispers of latecomers trying to decide between crotch view or the other view as they slid past people to find vacant seats. Excuse me, so sorry, excuse me, excuse me. The voice whispered close, just behind my ear. I half tuned into the darkness, tipped my head to show that I was listening. I'm afraid I can't see over your hair. I was embarrassed. It was not the first time it had happened. Oh, so sorry. I can back a bit, I whispered, moving to get up. And then I was stuck in the back row with the assorted tall people and the teenagers making out. At least the movie was decent. I was used to it. My hair often caused the chaos. Your hair be throwing gang signs, a swaggering teen yelled to me across the street one afternoon. And for a moment my hair tried on that identity. Street people and loyalty, colors and turf lines. Your hair is a fractal. My eccentric professor shouted up through the huge lecture hall, pen waving overhead, coffee-stained shirt, tie twisting undecipherably down his front. Some students turned to me in shock and confusion. But my hair just kept getting repeated patterns, a mathematical phenomenon, ripping through the follicles. You should rethink that hair, a businessman said as we walked the street together. You'll never get a job when you look like you smoke marijuana all day. And suddenly my hair was burning embers, herbed vapors, coiling above my head in a hazy spiral. But he held the door as we both stepped to enter the coffee shop, and I didn't tell him that I've never been without a job. Your hair is some crazy, a new lover said, hands wrapped in it as we interlaced in bed, trying to learn each other's bodies. Tangled roots, tangled legs, tangled lips, erotic labyrinth of sweat and skin, hair twisted across the sheets in knots. Your hair looks like snakes, my son said when we cuddled and read at bedtime, his sticky fingers running along my head. Serpentine and venomous, a fierce protective mama, a slithering Medusa, slinky and shrewd like the villain in all of his fantasy books. I love your colorful hat, a sweet old woman leaned over and said on the train, and I didn't have the heart to tell her that I wasn't wearing one. After the movie, I left with my big hair, left the theater, waited at the crosswalk for the light to change. A little girl stood near the corner with her mother, around 5, my daughter's age. Her mother looked stressed, distracted, kept arguing with someone on a cell phone. The little girl stared at me with wide eyes, never blinked. I raised my eyebrows, gave a sideways smile in greeting. Your hair is made of magic, she whispered, still staring, and I winked and nodded before her mother pulled her roughly across the street as the light changed. I crossed the street a few feet behind them, kept smiling at her, my hair shimmering spells of stars and alchemy. Thank you. And thanks to Anna Dugan for letting me read that.
Yes, thank you to you both. I am all ready. We're all set for. We're going to be introducing Ijoma Oluwu, a Seattle-based writer, speaker, and internet yeller. She was named one of the most influential people in Seattle by Seattle Magazine. She's the editor at large at The Establishment, a media platform run and funded by women. Welcome, Ijoma.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, Ijoma, how are you?
I'm doing really, I'm here.
Yeah. thank
how
you for
you?
Being here.
Ijoma is only in the studio via phone, just to let y'all know.
Yes, I have two children loudly, I don't know, doing home construction projects, it sounds like, in the other room, but I am here.
That's great. And we've already had Mari and Jenny read their pieces, and Ijoma, you're all ready?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
I'm going to read the piece that I wrote November 9th in response to this election for The Stranger. And it's called Good Morning America, Welcome to Your White Supremacy. Just the other day, I was saying that we should be looking at the post-Reconstruction South in order to understand what has been happening with Trump voters. But when I wrote those words, I was writing them with more than a little hope that when we got together to discuss this, it would be with a sense of relief of the tragedy that we had just narrowly avoided. But we did not avoid that tragedy. We did not even swerve. We stayed on that road that we paved hundreds of years ago, and we gunned it. And here we are. Good morning. Welcome to your white supremacist patriarchy. There will be a lot of hand-wringing and excuse-giving and scapegoating in the upcoming days as we try to grapple with what has just happened. But let's not get it twisted. Trump will be our next president, not because Hillary is unlikable, not because of third-party voters, not because of an enthusiasm gap in black voters. We have elected violent white supremacist patriarchy into office because the vast majority of white American voters chose to elect violent white supremacist patriarchy into office. This has been building from the moment Barack Obama was elected to the presidency 8 years ago. This was when the white supremacist patriarchy realized that they were losing a very important war. Equal marriage rights, Black Lives Matter, and then a female presidential candidate. Everything that the white supremacist patriarchy relies upon for its core identity has been under attack. And we have been gaining ground at lightning fast speed, leaving white supremacist patriarchy demoralized, bitter, and afraid. After the Civil War, after the South lost, a lot of effort was made to rebuild a new South, a South that could live in a new post-slavery world, a South where the real power no longer rested with those who owned other human beings. The reliance on the slave economy had already been hurting the South. The world had already begun to move past it. And there were hopes that this Reconstruction would resurrect the Southern economy and structure a new modern society. The ability to own slaves was more than just an economic reality. To many in the South, it was an identity of superiority and power. It was a birthright to wake up knowing that you were not black, you were not a slave, you were more. You inherited your slaves and your superiority like your father and his father before him. And the South would rather burn itself down before it lets that go. And what followed was a period of terror that left the Black forever scarred. It wasn't only the South that relied upon the oppression of others for its identity. The majority of white America has relied upon its identity of powerful, straight, Christian whiteness since this country's murderous inception. The majority of white males in America have been born expecting to be at the top of that hierarchy. But the rest of the country did not lose the Civil War. The rest of the country was not plunged into immediate identity crisis at the end of the 19th century. And as long as the South was distracting everyone with a sustained and very violent fit, the rest of white America was safe in their quiet positions of power. But progress came for the North eventually. Equality came for the rest of white America, and white America has responded with the same fear and hatred that the South responded to at the end of the Civil War. White America has proven once again that it would rather burn itself down and be king of the ashes than share a better world with everyone else. Do not think that you woke up in a different world. You woke up in the same white supremacist patriarchy that you've been waking up to your entire life. Know that this is why our country is the way it is. This is why our black men are in prison. This is why we have a gender wage gap. This is why our indigenous American brothers and sisters are currently being pepper sprayed and attacked by dogs for trying to protect our environment. This is why our women are being raped at a rate of 1 in 5. This is why white households have 12 times the wealth of black households and 10 times the wealth of Hispanic households. Because we live in a country that is so scared of change, it would elect Donald Trump for president. And we have always lived in that country. So now it's in the open. Now there is no denying that we live in a white supremacist patriarchy, that the majority of white people in just about every demographic in America voted for. Now we know that the problem isn't personal preference. It is not the economy. It is not lack of education. Now we know that there is no middle ground. Now we know that it is our very liberation that is the threat. So we can't give up. We must fight. We must continue the progress that has made the majority of white America so scared. And we must fight for that progress harder than ever before. Because there is only freedom or oppression. Now is the time for each of us to decide which of the two we will define ourselves by.
Thank you so much. We're gonna take just a tiny little break for this music, and then come back to discussion. It's a track from it's the first track by ourselves from Freetown Sound, the album Freetown Sound, by Blood Orange.
Wears a throwback jersey, bamboo earrings, and a face beat for the gods. Feminism is the rap Missy Elliott, Lil' Kim, and Angie Martinez on the Not Tonight track. Feminism says, as a woman in my arena, you are not my competition. As a woman in my arena, your light doesn't make mine any dimmer. Dear Missy, I did not grow up to be you, but I did grow to be me and be in love with who this woman is. To be a woman playing a man's game and not be apologetic about any of it. If you ask me where representation is important, I will tell you that on days I don't feel pretty, I hear the sweet voice of Missy singing to me, pop that, jiggle that fat, and don't stop, get it till your clothes get wet. I will tell you that right now there are a million black girls just waiting to see someone who looks like them.
Thank you. So if you're tuning in, this is Bread and Roses on KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Pamela Santos, and we've had Unchased Readers on. We still have on the line Ijoma Oluwu. I'm sorry I massacre your name. I'm sorry.
Oluwo.
A luo. I knew it. And Jenny Forrester in the studio and Mari Shepherd Glenn. So I'm just going to get right into it. The need for spaces like Unchase for women and non-binary writers to get heard where they don't usually get visibility. I mean, if there was such a need before, I hesitate to use the words that a lot of people use now, is now more than ever. We need this now more than ever. I'm going to start with Jenny and then we'll go around.
Mm-hmm. So I can't really answer this question without going back to the beginning of Unchased. Very briefly, I wanted to do something new because I heard I had just entered the literary scene. I had become a baby writer, like a real one. And I wanted to get into the scene. And I heard one too many poems that I just found utterly offensive. And so, I know, imagine that. And so I said, well, what can we do about this? Let's do our own thing, right? Because that's what we do, we reinvent. And fast forwarding to now, what we have is a series of different readings now each month. And they look very different from each other, even though the theme is always Unchased, reading your mind. The makeup looks different of each reading. And I think that's a good thing because I hope it's a good thing because there was a need to have only women of color readings. And so because of Portland, because of the experience of reading in a white space or a majority white space, being the only face that wasn't a white face. So when I talked to people, that was feedback that I got.
And how did you, and I'm going to let Ijoma answer this one. Ijoma, how did you get connected with Jenny and Unchased?
Oh.
Hold on. We might have lost Joma, but we'll go to Mari first.
Let's see, how did I get connected? I believe Jenny reached out to me. I was also a baby writer. And asked me if I wanted to participate, and I said yes. I was glad to have the opportunity. And honestly, the first, just never having experienced like really reading in public outside of school, it was like very nerve-wracking, but since that initial time, you know, I've progressed and grown as a writer, and each time gets easier with the performance aspect, and it's really awesome to see the evolution, starting just at on Alberta and then moving to having a set space at Literary Arts, which is cool.
I mean, I can speak to this a little bit. See, I always get reluctant, you know, telling everybody that, inserting myself sometimes in the show, but I'm also an Unchased reader. I read at the beginning of the year, and I had this process, before, and I had this overthink this a bit after, okay? And I knew that even though I hadn't really read for the first time in Portland until this, I didn't want the choice that I was going to make of whatever I wrote that I was going to read was going to have a greater significance because not only that I'm a woman of color, but I'm Filipino. And I write about things, whether or not they're exactly, Filipino, like directly, I think the style of how I write is Filipino. And so I actually overthought this a bit and I just went, oh, I don't want to insert this part. It's a story. It's a part of the story to mention like dog eating or eating dog. And it's like a specific reason that it's in there. But I really thought, and I told you this, Jenny, I really thought, oh my gosh, you know, these white people are going to leave and all they're going to remember is a Filipino girl said, you know, they ate dog or something. And it's one line, by the way. So it's one line. And the other side of that was, so like very specific things, but then I also thought, even though I had a lot of people, you know, tell me that it was good and my writing was, you know, a certain way, I think I still was working on imposter syndrome. And one, was it really good? Was it really good? Or the other side, which is, you know, white people might think that it's good because it's not anything they've heard before. And the novelty of women of color or just like writers of color talking about things like from a very specific and like authentic and genuine place, and that being so new and just not getting visibility, is that more important than them actually judging it for its quality and merit? You know, I still grapple with those questions. And Ijoma, I don't know if you heard that part of it. Ijoma? We're still checking. This is one of those things. It's live. It's live radio, you know? Like, it's live radio. And we'll keep trying to get her back on. This is the nature of having someone who is not physically in the studio. And we've done it before. But, Jenny, what do you think about what I just said?
So, if I could just sort of respond or something a little bit, speak to that. You came in this last year, the fifth year, the beginning of the fifth year. So we've been doing this for 4 years. And we had other readings that were all women of color, and we had pride readings, and we had plans right after that for multi-generational voices of Black women. And so it's not easy to communicate to people that, no, you're not the first person of color who's ever read at Unchased. You know, how do I make that? How do I communicate that? How do I make people comfortable? Because I feel like as a host, that's my job. Like, hello, welcome to the series, you know?
Hang on.
And it feels important to make people feel comfortable, and also feels necessary to create the right audience to hear it.
And I'm glad that you already know you're a good host.
I don't know how to communicate it all to be thoughtful with it. I mean, I do. I just try. I just say what I say and hope for the best, you know? And I just got a really nice answer from you both. That was really great. But I think it's important, obviously.
It is. It is. Ijoma?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yay!
My heart, like, actually, like, just, like, you know, shot one out there, like, ancestors, come through for me. Thank you. Thanks. All right, thanks. I mean, we're definitely talking about things that I've had these questions other times that that Unchased readers are on, but I think that we really have to be so specific about, like, this is the time now. Like, it is, there was a pre-election, and now this is our new reality that, especially with your piece, Ijoma, you know, good morning to everybody. Hi, white patriarchy supremacy is out in the open, and it's been there, but now you cannot, like, turn your eyes away. And like I said before, you know, it seems like the need for Unchased spaces, Unchased to be a space now, is so much more important, considering, I mean, who is going to be changing the lives of so many Americans, right?
Definitely.
What, if you could talk about, you know, what drew you to Unchased?
Well, I mean, mostly, you know, it's sort of just because Jenny asked me, and I've always thought she was wonderful, and, you know, I trusted her. And then the first time I went, you know, it was just, it was really lovely, and it felt welcoming. I don't do a lot of readings. I'm not a very social person, especially as a Black woman writer. It's very easy to be fetishized. It's very easy, you know, to feel overwhelmed with the type of attention you get when you read honest work in front of primarily white audiences, which is usually what you find in the Seattle, Portland area. And what I found when I went to Unchased was, you know, an environment. I went to a reading that was all women of color, and it was just beautiful. I mean, it was so wonderful to see these words, to enjoy words. Again, you know, I write about really tough things, and sometimes I really don't enjoy it at all. And it was really nice to be in a place where I could enjoy the beautiful words of other women of color. And so, you know, it's a wonderful thing that I really loved the environment. I loved how great Jenny was at making sure that, you know, readers felt safe. And it was lovely. I'm glad that she called in that favor, because it was a really lovely experience.
Good. Thank you. That really was an amazing reading, and we almost sweated to death.
Yes.
In other words, and then, but the experience of that just made me want something different. Yeah. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you for asking.
Mm-hmm. Mari, when did you read?
I've read what, like 3 times now.
I think the first time was at Pride. The local lounge.
Yeah, local lounge. And then after that, I read on Alberta too at the
Knockback.
And then more recently, there was a event as part of Lit Girl, mm-hmm. I believe, mm-hmm. at Tabor Space. So, yeah, three times now, 4 times.
Four now,
yeah.
And, like, would you say that it is a safe space?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've never felt uncomfortable there. And again, just to kind of reiterate, I think Jenny does a really good job at, like, preferencing and introducing and making sure the audience has a good understanding of, like, you know, if somebody is reading and sharing their heart, obviously, to how to approach them if you really like their work, and not just like, oh, you're so good,
you've trained, like, the audiences.
Well, so I say, don't come over surprised that we're articulate. Don't come over surprised that someone reads as well as a white man, or, you know, don't have a different reaction than you would to someone else who's assumed to be a writer, whether or not they are, mm-hmm. just because they're a white man.
Yeah, because I think there's a tendency when you see a person of, like, as for white people, when you see a person of color, to just want to, like, go up and say, you're so great, but then, like, there's a disconnect, obviously, because the narrative is different, and sometimes that can come off as, like, not really great for a person of color, and, like, kind of slightly offensive, because you're like, you don't really see me. You're just saying this and going through the motions of what you think you're supposed to say.
How can you tell when people really see you? And I'm saying that in the way that I found such comfort and love from my friends and chosen family, just saying the words, I see you, to me.
I think, like, it's just, if you're in touch with yourself, you can just, like, feel that. There's a difference in the feeling and the energy of somebody that actually sees you versus it's just saying the words.
What about you, Ijoma?
You know, I would say, I think there's always going to be limits on that, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're all still going to process it through our own, process words, especially through our own lenses. Mm-hmm. But I think that people are at least trying to see me when I can tell that they're actually listening to my words and responding to those. Mm-hmm. And not responding to what they think it says about them. And I think oftentimes that becomes really obvious as a writer. People come up to you and they'll start talking to you about your work, but what they'll start talking about is, you know, is in reaction to what they think it says about them. So I'll hear a lot of people come up to me and say, yeah, I get you. And then they'll spend 10 minutes trying to prove to me, you know, what sort of white person they are. And I can tell them what they're actually, you know, responding to, what they're looking at, their primary focus is on what my work says about them. And they're not really sitting with the words as they are. And I would say, you know, when people can just take the words, sit maybe, and take them on their own value before they start doing all of that extra work to try and make sure that they're okay in their eyes after reading it, is usually, you know, for me, a sign that they're reading it. And I think that, you know, oftentimes, you know, when we hear words from people that we think of as quote unquote authorities, right, respectable writers, which are usually, you know, white men, but we don't run those same filters through it. We just accept the words at face value. And we say, oh, that's, you know, a good idea. That's a good theory. That's a good sentence. You know, I like that. I didn't like it, but we don't go through and think of it all as a challenge or a threat to our identity. And a lot of even the most well-meaning white people sit down and read works of artists of color to see what it says about them and to see what it says about their relationship with people of color, instead of first just sitting with the words as they are.
Yeah, I'm absolutely just feeling all of this, just because I struggle to just say, I'm writing something, but then when you put it out in the world, okay, and then you're gonna be just responding to, just keep responding, you know, to other people's responses, and then it just becomes this loop that doesn't feel like, sometimes it gets farther and farther away from, let's say, the original writing. And I'm not even gonna get into, like, you know, social media networks, and that's a very specific, that's something else entirely. But I still found, I'm glad you had mentioned it, Ijoma, about, like, not being, let's say, like, with people, let's say. I just find writing to be such a solitary act, and that I know so many writers that's like, I'm actually an introvert. I don't like doing this. I don't like doing this promotion stuff or being, you know, actually with people when they consume my writing.
If I liked people, I couldn't spend all day in my own head. It has the opposite effect on you the more that you do it. So I'm not a people person. That's why I write.
So let me even get into just like the meat of why I was inviting you all specifically, is that that's the problem that I'm still trying to figure out, is writing spaces being so white. You know, elsewhere, like, yes, publishing and all of these things, but, like, especially just here in the Pacific Northwest, to, you know, you go through any other space and you're like, okay, I'm going to take some writing classes or workshops. I'm going to find a writing group. I'm going to connect with other people. I'm going to try to check out, you know, maybe some mentors, try to figure out what do I have to do to be an agent, or, you know, shop my stuff around to be a part of writing communities, right? There's all these kind of, what I feel like these, you're forced to kind of be in these social spaces, to be able to get visibility, to get your work out. And the thing that I was telling Jenny before, this show, is that I think, people have to make the ones that are curating and in charge of writing spaces, whatever that could be in the writing community, they actually have to work extra hard. They actually have to make a special effort to make sure that writers of any gender and color are going to be represented. And that means that you don't say, well, it was open to everybody, so, you know, they could have come to me if they wanted to, or whatever it could be, the excuse. But even in the most supposedly progressive and equitable spaces, there's going to be barriers for writers of color, you know, whether it starts from not going to the same schools or like alma maters as certain people, definitely not going and having like going to writing programs in college or grad school. You make, you know, that community there as well. But also not having the time, like economic situations being like, clearly, you know, there are certain barriers for certain people more than others, right? And so you're not going to be free to write all the time, get time away from your family or your job. And so you do that, but then you get into the writing spaces and then they're racist and there's microaggressions. So how have, I mean, this is such a big lead up setup in Joma, but like how do you think you've tried to at least tackle that in your own way, especially with the establishment?
You know, I was very lucky with the establishment, and I must say, you know, I almost feel bad answering this question for a lot of people because so much of what I have is luck. And I think that, you know, if you are a writer of color and you feel like you can't, you're not getting anywhere, and you feel like it's really, really hard, and then you look at me, know that you're not, you know, it's not in your head. It is that hard, and I just got really, really, really lucky. You know, I left my job to write full-time without a plan, and I happened to leave right at the time that the establishment was launching, and I had already worked with the editors there. And I trusted them, and I had avoided signing up, you know, with any publications. I work mostly freelance still, and I had done that because, as a writer of color, you know, I think what has helped me is, before I was a writer, I worked in advertising for a very long time. I was very familiar, you know, I was very aware of what your reputation means and how easily that could be changed. And so, I knew that as a new writer, I didn't want to sign on to anyone who would then turn my words into their words, you know, especially as a writer of color and a woman. So often there's so much pressure from editors that if you want to write with them, you have to have this certain voice that they're used to seeing. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be known for my voice. And I had been working with the founding editors in a previous publication. And when they left to start the establishment, they called me and asked if I wanted to be a part of it. So I really kind of lucked out on the timing, you know, of it all. But, you know, I would say it is hard. The gatekeepers to many writing circles, even female writing circles, oftentimes have issues with race, with class, with disability that prevent the people whose voices we need to hear most from being heard. And I'm really lucky in that I don't need those groups so much anymore. And I was a part of some of those larger groups in the beginning. And I tell you, you know, it was the tax I had to pay to get a few contacts, right, to get a few places to spread the pitch was so high. I remember having nights just having migraines from all of the drama, all the insensitivity, all of the ways in which women of color, you know, trans women, gay women, disabled women were having to bend over backwards, and the parts of themselves they were having to ignore in order to get the access they needed in order to get their work seen. And that was really, really stressful. And, you know, part of what I try and do now is to alleviate that for other women of color, you know, and I try and network with other women writers of color and other trans writers of color and other disabled writers to, you know, kind of bypass all of that and try and get editors used to seeing diverse writers, because it really is a strong boundary. And so if you're feeling like you've hit that wall, it's a real wall. It's not in your head.
Yeah, this is so validating. And I also think this is still going back to I see you, you know, like I think talking about things as being valid is just another way to. Mari, is there any ways that you like cope, or, you know, what do you need to like get by and navigate these spaces?
Well, I would say I haven't really been in a lot of these spaces. Honestly, I cope though by sharing my words with other people of color. and kind of seeking just, you know, validation that way, or just like, this is what I'm going through. Can you be a soundboard? I think that, though, as far as like going into literary spaces, and the little amount that I have, I've noticed it seems that there's like a level of like white respectability / microaggressive politics that control the environment there. And there's this weird like marking system. It seems that if you don't have a 4-year degree, check, like you're bumped down. Mm-hmm. If you're a person of color, bumped down. If you're a woman, if you're trans, if you're disabled, and so on and so forth. Mm. And so, like, I think that really plays into and affects the, like, ICU status or lack of.
This isn't necessarily something that's, like, a lighter tone, but it could be interpreted that. I definitely talk to other artists of color, not just writers of color, and we talk about this thing called white mediocrity. And I don't know if you gentlemen knows where I'm going with this. Yeah? Yeah? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. That it can feel so deflating as well to see what seems like mediocre, just not even bland. Like, I've heard this stuff before. Like, I've heard this stuff before, and have it be represented by someone with privilege, and constantly, you know, like, to see people move up like that, it can be so deflating at the same time that you are struggling too. It's not just like we're in this vacuum, right? Gentlemen, do you have another word other than what I, you know, white mediocrity?
No, I mean, yeah, it's mediocrity. Like, you know, it's what it is. That's what happens when nobody challenges you, when you never push to do better, you know?
Yes.
Like, I could, you know, I can win the Olympics if I'm not going against anyone who's had to train for them, you know? Like, that's kind of how it works.
Can we just even just say that our president-elect right now is like the pinnacle of unqualified white mediocrity, if not like substandard?
You know, I would say, you know, what's interesting about him is he's actually the best at stereotypical white maleness. Like, he won that.
Yeah.
Like, he really did win that. He went all out. He was everything. He was the extreme of everything that we tell our white men that they should be, right? He was rich, bold, sexually assaulting, racist, power-hungry creep. And that's exactly what we tell our white men they're supposed to be. He was all of it. Like, he actually was, he wasn't mediocre at it. He won because he won that contest. He won. He is Mr. Male USA. Like, he got that whole thing, and he felt like home to white America, and he got elected.
He wins top marks in white cis hetero patriarchy.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And the hardest thing, I think, about what's to come, I think, is knowing that we already, and I'm just going to be upfront with this sometimes, we already have limitations on what we can say on the radio. But my personal opinion about it affects women the most, because it's the way that we talk about certain things that you can't, you know, do a certain way. So you change how you say it this way, and you change how you say this stuff this way. And I'm not even going to say the word, because, you know, I know they already said it on TV a million times, and I'm not about to do this right now. But he made the word that we get in trouble for, okay? Mm-hmm. We got in trouble for things sometimes, but, you know, radio people cannot say that. Usually when it's even if it's in the title of a song or part of a song or the band, but grabbing kitties and whatnot, that became okay to say out loud on TV because he said it. Because you have to, you know, say it. So, yeah, that was my tiny little bit rant. I don't know if you want to respond to that, Joe. Like,
you know, I think that a lot of what we're seeing right now is a reaction to the progress that we've made. And I think that right now, my biggest fear is that I already see the calls for reconciliation coming out. And that's the exact opposite, because what this was a, you know, huge, all-out, forceful effort to stall the progress that we've been making and try and turn it back. Right? When people say make America great again, what they're saying is they want to rewind and take back to when they were comfortable, they knew where they stood, you know, and mm-hmm. they knew where everyone else stood below them. And so a lot of the calls now for us to come together and things like that are basically calls for us to fall in line. And what we need to do is push harder than ever. Mm-hmm. Because in so many ways, we were lax. And in that way, we were able to be divided. And I think that we forget that, right? People say, oh, but we have been fighting. We have been fighting. But we've been picking our battles. And we've been picking our battles according to how they appeal to us and how important they are to us individually. And so I know so many, you know, I knew so many white women who, you know, would fight for abortion. But they weren't going to fight. They weren't going to say Black Lives Matter. You know, I know.
White feminism is the other show coming up.
Yeah, and this extends across too, right? You know, I don't know many anti-racist activists who are also fighting for, you know, disabled people in their community, right? Mm-hmm. And people were, but it wasn't something that was fully embraced. And I don't know how many times, as you know, a Black queer woman, I was told by every group I identify with that some part of my activism was a distraction, that some part of my activism didn't belong. And that's what got us, because we were able to look at someone who didn't fit our closest needs and justify that and put that on par with someone who was, you know, openly threatening over half of our population. And, you know, in those cracks, white supremacy falls through, right? Because people will literally say it's the same thing. And we're even saying that, right? So often I'm hearing so many people say that this is because we didn't elect someone liberal enough, or it wasn't Jill Stein, or it wasn't Bernie Sanders, or blah, 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 blah. And we're basically equating that with openly picking violent white supremacist Islamophobia, ableism, and sexism, right? And we have to... And it's because we weren't united. It's because we haven't been practicing intersectionality that those gaps have been allowed to be there. And I think that now is the time we really, really need to look at that. We need to start calling it all out. We have to keep pushing, because all of these calls for us to come together, all of this, these calls for us to find common ground, there is no middle ground here. There's no middle ground here. And when we try and find the common ground with hate and bigotry, all we do is integrate hate and bigotry into our goals. You know, there's no way to chuck that later. So I think that that's something that we need to really be aware of and really be vigilant against. We have to remember that this started because we were making progress, but we weren't strong enough to withstand it because we allow ourselves to be so easily fractured. And we're fractured at the point where we decide to leave our most needy behind because it's harder. And we need to start saying, no, we're going to actually do all of the hard work so that we aren't leaving anyone behind, so that when it comes time to really fight this, we can really make enough progress so that in 2 years, in 4 years, in 8 years, we are not once again picking this for our country.
It's like I've been silently, like my body wanted to do the emojis when you put your hands in the air and doing all this. This has been an amazing hour with everybody. And I'm just going to wrap up by just allowing folks, we only have 2 minutes or less, not even, left. To just go out on just whatever you'd like to let people know and close with. Joma?
I would just want to say that, you know, we're all still here. This is what I was saying all night of the election. I'm still here. You're still here. We are still the same people we were. And we still have the same potential we had. And as long as we're here and we're willing to fight together, we can get through this. We have been getting through this, and remember that this is not a different world than it was yesterday or it was last week. We have been getting through this, and we will continue to, and we've been making progress, and we will continue to.
Thanks. Mari?
Just to second on Yoma, I have seen really the community here, particularly in Portland, in a weird way, like, be strengthened and, like, come together by this, and almost immediately after, like, the initial, like, grieving process, wanting to talk about how we can create safe spaces, what that looks like, and how we can be inclusive and have intersectionality in that.
Unchased Reader, I didn't know how fast I need to go. Unchased Reader Series has a Kickstarter project. Look up Unchased Reader Series print edition. We have lots of really great writers in there. Please donate if you can. Thank you.
And just to highlight that, it's really important. I think what you've been doing is trying to make sure that people are compensated.
Yes.
And so the important part of raising funds for this, and as I've seen you do for the events, is make sure that the readers, but especially like the writers of color, were compensated too.
Yes.
This has been a great night. I'm Pamela Santos for Bread and Roses. We're here every Friday, 6 p.m. And thank you so much for listening. Thanks to our engineers, Evening Public Affairs Director, Lisa Loving as well. You can connect on the KBOO website, find us on Facebook and Twitter. And we're gonna be going out on, this is just honestly just a short interlude from Solange's A Seat at the Table album. It's that interlude, Tina Taught Me.
I think part of it is accepting that it's so much beauty in being Black. And that's the thing that I guess I get emotional about, because I've always known that. I've always been proud to be Black. Never wanted to be nothing else. Loved everything about it. Just, it's such beauty in Black people. And it really saddens me when we're not allowed to accept.